Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of September 2019. Welcome to episode 52 of this podcast series, so it's time to reboot with a new number one. Oh wait, sorry, we're not DC Comics here, we're just a podcast. There's no reason to do that. Of course, there's never a good reason to do that. Now, the concept of this show is to just have a brief conversation, a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this pretty much the comics I read during September. These issues are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. But those posts are not exactly spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. Based on the picture that accompanied the post for last episode, Pat Sampson from the Longbox Crusade admitted that he thought he had the Kool-Aid Man comic when he was a kid, to which Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, made the obvious reply,
"Oh yeah."
We heard from Carla Y., who had thoughts on two of the titles I talked about last episode. This will probably sound slightly shocking, but I actually don't care for this run of Justice League Dark. I am indeed slightly shocked by that, Carla. She said she could only get partway through the first trade. "I love Wonder Woman. She's what got me into DC 2 or 3 years ago, but I don't like her in this. She comes off at times a bit too high and mighty for me. I did like what Jason Blood said during the meeting at his mansion with the other Darks. He said something like the only reason the lights are even speaking to us is because they need our help. True dat. I do appreciate John's makeover, though. The long black coat and slick back hair and a vintage car, if he's actually allowed to drive it. It's nice not seeing him as though he woke up in an alley somewhere. LOL. Now, with that being said, I really do want to read issue 13, but is it really that heartbreaking between him and Z? I may need to prepare myself." Oh, my poor, dear, dear Carla. Yes, you need to be in a safe, emotional space when you read that issue. She continued that she was pleasantly surprised that I liked Cardcaptor Sakura, a book that she sent in. "I know it was a slight risk, but I thought even if it wasn't your cup of tea, I know it would find a home with someone down the line. Yes, that is the way of the hashtag comic book circle of life. Understand, lovely listeners, that if you send me comics, a few of them stay in my collection forever. A handful go to M. Many others get donated to other lovely listeners, unless they're from Rob Lance and they fall apart in my hands, in which case they go into the recycling box." Carla says that that was a quarter bin find from her local LCS, an anime shop. "I found about 20 single issues last summer, almost the whole early 2000s run, before they stopped selling single manga issues. I had picked up two of the same issues without realizing it. I'd never read the manga before. I'd only had watched the badly dubbed and edited Kids WB version back in high school, but she had an itch to start reading it," Carla says, "when she found out that Clamp was starting a whole new series called Clear Card, where Sakura is now a teenager. I have the final omnibus to read, then I can jump into Clear Card hopefully before winter. That's been my plan, but I get distracted." Oh, we all get distracted, Carla. Thank you. Always good to hear from you. For me, when you throw all of those magical characters into one book like Justice League Dark, even with a story that's not wholly original, they're just so many characters in there that I like. Detective Chimp, Zatanna and Zatara Swampy, Johnny Conjob, Doc Fate, Wonder Woman leading the charge. I can't resist, personally. The generous Canadian Rob Lance commented that he felt bad just how all over last episode he was. Not sure if I should apologize or thank my co-stars. Well, Sir Rob, I guess that's what you get for being so generous. Canadians. Am I right, people? And the excellent Nathaniel Wayne of the excellent Council of Geeks, excellent YouTube channel, had a few thoughts on my giving Tom King a pass on the whole wedding, non-wedding Batman 50 kerfuffle. The title of his email, Tom King, King of Lies, is kind of a spoiler for how he feels. Dear Professor, in the latest episode of the Reading Journal, what jumped out at me was your assessment of the now somewhat infamous Batman 50. I feel that there's a major factor in the bad taste left by that issue which you did not address or acknowledge, and that's the issue I personally have with the whole thing. Now, full disclosure, I have not actually read the issue. You may therefore, rightly, question how I can have any kind of fair objection to something I have not, in fact, read. Actually, Nathaniel, I think you can have opinions about things you haven't read, or watched, or consumed. You can have opinions on the concept, on the previews that you've read so far. You can even have reactions to reviews and what other people have said about it. That's not the same as going in completely blind. Anyway, what Nathaniel says is, the issue I have is a media one, see? That exists completely independent of the execution and instead lies at the crossroads of core idea and creator-fueled lead-up. You see, what infuriated me about the entire thing is that in the months leading up to issue 50, Tom King gave multiple interviews that effectively boiled down to, yes, we're really doing this. I remember distinctly one where he even said something along the lines of, so many writers say that a stable relationship limits a character, but I think it opens up storytelling possibilities that nobody is exploring. And the thing is, he was 100% right about that. So to find out that he was talking completely out of his backside and bold-facedly lying just ticks me off. Of course, he's far from the only creator to be guilty of this. Let's be clear about that. Marvel made the same mistake with the Captain America Agent of Hydra storyline by insisting that they were really doing this, swearing up and down that it wasn't any kind of alternate reality or shenanigans. Surprise, it was an altered reality. Of course it was. Or J.J. Abrams, in insisting that Benedict Cumberbatch was totally not in any way whatsoever playing Khan in Into Darkness. And all the people working on James Bond, who swore up and down that Christoph Waltz was definitely in no way at all not playing Blofeld, Inspector. Now every time it's the same excuse. We wanted to preserve the surprise. If you want to preserve a surprise, just don't talk about what's in the thing. Just answer every question with, you'll find out when you read it, or see it. Just don't lie to us, because it's downright insulting. Because when fans figure out what you're up to, and then you lie to them to pretend like they didn't actually do that, two things happen. The first is, the product lands like a damp squib, because it's, ha, we totally fooled you, and fans are going, no you didn't, we called it, and then you lied to us. Which then leads to point two, you're training fans not to believe you. The instant any creator, publisher, studio, etc. pulls that, they've sent the message, never take us at our word again. Heck, Abrams seems to have learned the best from his mistakes, because even though he still employs his often lame mystery box stories, he at least has opted to just be tight-lipped about whatever he works on, rather than deceitful, ever since Star Trek Into Darkness blew up in his face. He burned his benefit of the doubt, and has been smart enough to not ask for it ever since. Even if the wedding issue itself is part of a masterpiece of sequential art and storytelling, the fact that its creator played into this insulting tendency sours the entire endeavor, as far as I'm concerned. And if you haven't seen Linkara lose his freaking mind over the Booster Gold segment that preceded the wedding, I advise you to hop onto YouTube and seek it out, and maybe even subscribe to the Council of Geeks YouTube channel while you're there. It's amazing. I haven't seen him get that red-hot furious in a while, and even if you disagree with his reasons, He's always entertaining. Great listening as always. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne. Nathaniel has a YouTube channel called Council of Geeks? Huh. Buddy, you need to be more bold about promoting that. I mean, you hardly ever mention it. On the specifics of Nathaniel's points, maybe this is one of the, I'd say advantages, but maybe one of the facts about not reading these issues while the hype train is rolling down the tracks, but looking at them 6, 9, 12 months later. The ability to just focus on the work itself and not the related shenanigans. It's a little like separating art and artist, the separating of art and marketing. Specifically on the aspect of creators' creative promotional lying, I don't get hung up on puffery, a marketing term meaning the making of general comments about the work that's being promoted. But in the cases that you've cited, Nathaniel, certainly all of those went well beyond that. And making specific black and white comments that are just not true in the least, that is over the line. I am completely with you on J.J. Abrams on that point. And also with movie previews and trailers containing scenes that are not in the movie itself, to me, that is so low. That is completely out of line. Now, maybe I have a double standard on comics. I don't know, because I've been trained to not believe hype. Reading Stan Lee's columns in the 1970s and 80s maybe immunized me into believing everything the comic book company said about their products. But I am with you. It's tricky. The companies want the benefit of promotion, getting their creators out there, interacting with fans, answering questions. But the risk is being asked a direct question and not having the wherewithal to effectively dodge said question. One of the drawbacks with using freelancers is that they can't mandate media training or completely control their appearances and statements because they're not employees. Controlling them too much, giving them too many scripts and particular answers to give, that runs the risk of them being a little too close to employees for comfort. And the companies certainly want to avoid that at all costs. So that's the good old risk-return trade-off that's happening here. And yes, the Booster Gold diversion was a bit odd, but at least in the trade, it was only a 20-minute diversion, not a 60-day diversion. And that makes all the difference. And we heard from Certified Brit, Sir Martin of Grey, who talked about one of the free Comic Book Day issues that I read last time. I'd never heard of that UK Funny Pages book, but I grew up on the likes of Grimly Fiendish, Sweeney Todd, and Gums. Love them. I know that those words in Sir Martin's comments were in English, and I supposedly speak English, but I have no idea what he was talking about. That last episode also received social media love from Paul from the Nexus of All Realities podcast, Dungeon Choir, Fan Film Fridays, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, The Long Box of Darkness, Ed Moore, The Collected Edition podcast, Luke Giaconetti from Earth Destruction Directive, the Between the Pages blog, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, author Jim Fanning, Comics in the Golden Age, Debster 70, Canada Daredevil, Derek William Crabb, Jay Campbell, The Liquid Awesome, Bill Baer from the Batpod, J. Jones Goldstein from comics.blog, Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond, and Gene Hendricks from The Hammer Strikes. Thanks for those supports, everybody. That was a good amount of feedback, and I appreciate it all. So let's take a break here, and when we come back, we will start talking about the comics that I read during September.
You know, a dear friend once said to me, it's a lot of fun when everyone's a dork of some sort or another. And I thought not only are those words to live by, it's an idea worth celebrating. So that's why I created Pop Culture Affidavit, a podcast that is about, well, let's just say it's completely random. One episode might be about movies, the next might be about comics, the next might be about music. All that matters is that I'm giving you a recap and critique of stuff I enjoy, and you're having as much fun as I am, or at least I hope. So join me, Tom Paneris, for Pop Culture Affidavit, the sworn testimony of a dork. You can find a new episode at least once a month at popcultureaffidavit.podomatic.com, and notes, essays, and other stuff once a week at popcultureaffidavit.com.
And we're back to talk about the books I read last month. And as I do on this show, I'm categorizing the comics that I read. And first are the ones I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. For Quarterbin Podcast 143, I read the very obscure Gods for Hire number 1 from the very obscure Hot Comics from the very obscure year of 1986. And comics I read for listening to podcasts, and there are more of these than usual, because DC Universe app. And I love following along with comic book podcasts if I have the chance, and the app gives me more opportunities to have that chance. So for listening along with Nightcast, episode 24 on the Fire and Water Network, I read Batman 413 and Detective Comics 580. For listening to our great good friend Laurel and her squad on the Hunters podcast, I read Hunters 18 and 19 to follow along with episodes 18 and 19. And now that that first volume, the 1990 volume, is wrapped up, I look forward to seeing where that podcast goes next. And to listen along with Mike Peacock's triumphant return to podcasting with new episodes of Justice's First Dawn, I read Justice League 81 through 83. Again, all of those were on the DC Universe app. Which brings us to new comics that we read right off the shelves. Dial H for Hero 5 and 6. I'm not sure why, but I've gotten in the habit of reading these two at a time, because of just how serialized the story is. Of course, that does argue against the notion of buying them fresh off the shelves, if the way that I read them more closely resembles trade waiting. But, at least for this book, at least for now, that's how I'm reading it. The Dial H verse has definitely grown in this series. That is its main contribution to the legend of the H dial. In these, the operator, who at one point in his life was H. Dialer Robbie Reed, Sakamajee. He is trying to explain to Miguel how the H-verse works, but the evil Mr. Thunderbolt managed to send everyone in Metropolis a text, convincing them all to dial H. And all at once, thousands upon thousands of costume characters appear, including a Super Miguel. But this was just a test run for Mr. Thunderbolt, First Metropolis. Next, the multiverse. Oh, and did I mention that part of this takes place at the old headquarters of the Justice League in Detroit? Justice League Dark number 14, this picks up after last month's excellent annual, in which Jason Woodrew helped create a new leadership for the Green, the Parliament of Flowers. He is part of the Battle of Witches, the Witching War. Wonder Woman thinks she finally knows who is behind all of this after listening to Constantine, which is always a risky move. Detective Chimp is doing his best in the war, but good guy Man-Bat may have been compromised by Clarion the Witch Boy. Legion of Superheroes Millennium number 1. If you've heard anything about this issue, you've heard this one thing. And Jeff, the owner of my LCS, even warned me of this when I picked up the issue from him, and that is that the Legion is not exactly in the issue. At least not the traditional members of the Legion. We don't know who might be included in this new version. I assume that Rose Forrest of Rose and Thorn will be joining because she has a very large role in this issue, and a mysterious one at that. The mystery is, how has she survived for 1,000 years? Because that's what this issue does. It gives us a brief overview of DC Comics history from the current day to the age of the Legion a millennium away. I am glad to have the Legion back, and this did what it was meant to do, but I would like to see some actual Legion next issue of this before the new Legion book starts up. And from the good folks of Alterna, providers of newsprint comics at the awesome price of $1.50, I wrapped up a miniseries by reading Unit 44, number 4. We wrap up the whole alien invasion plotline without too much drama, and focus back on the life of the government flunkies who forgot to pay the bill on the storage unit, getting this whole thing going in the first place. And there are some new hires, and even a promotion for one member of our cast. It wasn't the best thing I've read from Ultra, but it was a fun read, a quick read, and I would consider reading another storyline from this title. From Alterna, I also read Midnight Mysteries, City of Ghosts 1 and 2. This is the first half of a series that follows up on one I read last year. Zeke King is a private eye who specializes in the unknown, while also searching for mysteries from his past life. In his present life, he has stumbled into a criminal enterprise which believes in leaving no loose ends, and which creates pawns or drones who are under someone's control, and they are all about leaving no loose ends. And unfortunately for Zeke, he is a loose end. And on to the general comic reading that I did. Sorry, Rob Lance, we're going to mention your name a lot in this episode as well. Maybe not as much as last time. But that's because the generous Canadian sent a ton of comics a month or two ago, and it's going to take me a while to get through them all. So this one's for you, Sir Rob Lance of the Comic Connection in Oakville, Ontario. So among the books he sent were The Further Adventures of Indiana Jones No. 1 from Marvel from 1983. It's John Byrne and Terry Austin doing their thing, and doing it very well. They pull off that artistic trick where Indy doesn't really look like Harrison Ford. I don't think they had likeness rights. But it does kind of look like Indiana Jones, if you know what I mean. And of course, there's a globe-spanning adventure, light humor, and a dramatic cliffhanger. In other words, everything you could ask for. And that was definitely better than Human Fly No. 2. And they're trying to build some mystery about a secret identity, but that's not really enough to build drama. And maybe it's because it's a licensed book based on a real person, but it's just really bland. The stunts would be interesting in real life, but maybe comics aren't the best medium for portraying that type of event. Now, Bill Mantlo, Carmine Infantino, they're talented creators, but I don't think, at least here in issue number 2, that they just knew what to do with the character and with this book. And Hot Rods and Racing Cars 114 and Grand Prix 30, two books from the early 1970s. Now, I had Matchbox cars and Hot Wheels and a couple of pretty great slot car tracks over the years. But with the possible exception of an issue or two of Wacky Racers, I don't remember reading any car or racing related comics. But this big box of comics from Sir Rob had a handful of those, including some I talked about last month. These ones were fine enough, and they were a cool look into a weird, small corner of comics publishing. Fun reads. In DC, Comics Presents No. 8, Superman and Swamp Thing, going up against Solomon Grundy. Actually going up against a lot of Solomon Grundys. You know those legends of crocodiles and other beasts living in the New York City sewers? Well, this story involves multiple Solomon Grundys bursting out from the Metropolis sewers. And along with Dr. Clyburn at Star Labs, Superman is able to take care of Grundy while Swampy shambles away. And Millie the Model, 194 and 197 from Marvel Comics, of course. These ones were published in the early 70s, but were reprints from the 60s. And I have to say that these were funnier than I expected. We know that Stan wanted to write the great American novel, but I think maybe second to that was his desire to be a stand-up comic, or at least a professional joke writer. And some of the lines in here are better than others, sure, and not everything works 50-plus years later, but these were both kinda fun reads. There are obvious similarities to Archie, but just aging these characters into their 20s and putting them in the professional world, that makes a nice difference. The books sort of stand out and weren't that bad. Now, from the 50-cent bins at Pulp Reality, I read Black and White number 2 from Image because, well, I think I was swept away by the atmosphere in the shop, the 50-cent prices, and the incense. The owner burns incense in the store, so I can't be held accountable for every purchase I make there. Okay? There's clearly an under-the-influence scenario happening here. Because although I didn't hate number 1 when I read it a few months back, there's no real reason why, with a clear head, I would buy number 2. But buy it, I did. And it was okay. Let me put it this way. If we're ever shopping together, and you see me reaching for Black and White number 3, please tackle me. I mean, tase me if you need to. I really don't need to know how this story ends, okay? Would you just be a good friend? And from that used bookstore, I also nabbed Star Trek 15 and 18 from the old Gold Key run from the 70s. The stories were more general science fiction tales. They could have easily been Mystery in Space or some other similar title. So in terms of Star Trek, they tend to fall short. The moral and ethical questions that are there in so many of the original series episodes aren't there at all. But they aren't bad, generic, Silver Age-y sci-fi stories, whether the story's about a space Bermuda Triangle or a plan to shrink an entire planet and hold it for hostage. But the trappings of Star Trek, the characters, the Enterprise, phasers, the transporter, even when those things aren't used well, they do all help with the reading experience, at least in terms of bringing some nostalgia to the reading. And at least to me, nostalgia doesn't have to be a bad thing. And as part of his uncollecting process, Tom Panarese recently sent me a care package of comics, including a Malibu book from 1993, Protectors number 8, which was not very nice on Tom's part, to be honest. Now, this team and this issue featured the ferret, and Tom and I have a sordid and bloody history with the ferret. This one featured the team in the aftermath of the death of one of the members, and they used the funeral as a trap for their mortal enemy, Mr. Monday and his steel army. Tom, I will remember this. And thanks to the kind and generous Catherine and Charlotte Adams, who host the Mark's Mess podcast with their father. Mark. That's right, Mark. Now, I won a contest on their show, and my prize package included some comics, including Arion, Lord of Atlantis, number 1. I think I may have read this back when it was out, or at least in that general era of when it was out. But I didn't really have a recollection of it, so this more or less counts as a new read. So anyway, we are in 45,000 BC, and we've got a battle in the cosmos, and a battle under the seas, and a battle for the future of Earth. It all comes together in Arion. There's a lot of standard fantasy stuff, which doesn't have to be a bad thing. Although there's a lot of text-based backstory in this first issue, and I tend to like that sort of thing when it's more like slowly unrolled over the first few issues, or if it's a novel, the first few chapters. But I think I'm intrigued by the world, the settings, the characters, so not a bad start. And from Carolina Comics and More, direct from the 3-for-a-buck box, I grabbed Battle World, Adelin Rising, number 1. And this is a case of the parts being better than the whole, because you have things I like here. Doom controlling an entire patchwork planet. What's not to like about that? And how about Queen Medusa and all that red hair? And the Ghost Rider as a 30s-era tough guy? And even the Thor Corps? Maybe this all works out over the length of the 5 issues, but this one, by itself, doesn't really motivate me to find out. And from Carla Y., who became one of the latest members of the comic book Circle of Life by sending some books from Ollie's grab bags a few months ago, including The Saga of Crystar, the Crystal Warrior from Marvel from 1983. As was often the case with early issues of a new title, with brand new characters, this one featured a guest star. In this case, it was Doctor Strange. And he brought a different kind of sorcery and magic than what the Crystal Warriors were used to. So I'd never read any issues of this before, but it was interesting. I will give it that. Carla also sent Silver Sable and the Wild Pack, number 8 from 93. The premise of the series is interesting. A lady trained to be a world-class mercenary, leading a world-class mercenary unit. This one was a bit 90s for my taste, for me to really love it. But I did like aspects of it, and I think I kind of dig Silver Sable herself. And some kids' books that I read mostly from Sir Rob's care package were Top Cat 14, Partridge Family number 9, Sad Sack Navy Gobs and Gals 4 and 6, Sad Sack Laugh Special 65, Sad Sack World 27, Harlem Globetrotters number 2, Everything's Archie 73 and 191, and 6 issues of Woody Woodpecker. Now, I have read a lot of kids' books over the years, and a lot of TV tie-in books. And some of these are okay. Certainly, some are better than others, and some, you know, really fall short. But I have to say that Partridge Family number 9 may be the worst comic book I've read in a long time, and I recently read Gods for Hire number 1. Lessons that make no sense, ending punchlines that just aren't funny, that make no sense, storylines that are pretty dumb, and every ad in the book, everyone, is Partridge Family related. So this is totally, completely, 100% licensed and controlled. The only good thing was that this meant that the likenesses are really good. But other than that, wow, not good. And no, nobody else is getting this from me via the hashtag comic book circle of life, because it was falling apart as I read it, and because I like you all as listeners, I wouldn't wish this comic upon any of you. Not even Shag. And the Top Cat issue from Gold Key from 1965 had one of those statement of ownership in it, and it's looking at documents like that that you realize just how far our beloved hobby has fallen in terms of general popularity. This comic, Top Cat, I know it was a long time ago, but I don't know that this was ever a, pardon the pun, top-level property. But Top Cat printed up just over 400,000 copies per issue, selling a touch over a quarter million each. That is a crazy big number. All right, time to take another break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about all the graphic novels, trade paperbacks, and long runs that I read in September.
Are you tired of fanboy comics podcasts? Looking for a show that really appreciates the comic storytelling medium and how it works? A show that looks at comics from any genre and anywhere in the world, comparing the storytelling techniques of different creators and different comics cultures, with manga, newspaper strips, European comics, and more discussed alongside mainstream U.S. comics? A show that includes talks with well-known creators like James Robinson and Dan Jurgens, and with less famous creators that you really should know. And hey, we'll even critique your comic. If you're looking for that show, then you're looking for Deconstructing Comics, and it's right here at deconstructingcomics.com. Also available in iTunes and on Stitcher. This is Tim saying check out our show every Monday. That's Deconstructing Comics.
And we're back to talk about trades, long runs, and miniseries that I read last month. And in anticipation of the great and wonderful release of Doctor Doom number 1 next week, stay tuned to this podcast feed for more discussion about that in the future. I read a couple of Doom-related titles from about 20 years ago. Two of these were picked up at Pulp Reality, and one was sent in by the kind and generous Dr. Ange. And we'll talk a little bit about how he got his and who signed it after we talk about Heroes Reborn Ashima, Heroes Reborn Doom, and Heroes Reborn Doomsday. These were all written by Chris Claremont and Mike McCone, with art by Mark McKenna, Michael Ryan, and Don Williamson. And Ashima and Doom were pretty good, although there were enough of these early 2000 characters that were unknown to me that some of the drama, I'm sure, was probably lost on me. Now, Doomsday, on the other hand, was excellent, partly because it leads very well into the Doom miniseries a number of months later, written by Chuck Dixon. We talked about that miniseries here back in the May 2018 episode of this very podcast. Now, in this one, Doom manages to make it back to the Baxter Building with the help of the woman named Lancer, who eventually he leaves in charge, returning in that Chuck Dixon mini. So having that future context for the story, to be able to think about how this was going to manifest in that later series, was very helpful. And the Doom in this one was nuanced, I think. Claremont did a really good job of capturing Doom's voice, especially in that issue. I mentioned Dr. Ange, and he sent me this copy signed by both Chris Claremont and Mike McCone. Ange stood in the long line for Claremont, and while just about everyone else was plopping down their classic X-Men issues, and he was signing them without really looking up, Ange gives him this Doomsday issue, and he stops, flips through it, start to finish, as Ange said, almost rereading it. And talking, not really to Ange, maybe to his assistant, maybe to the universe at large. And Claremont says he's kind of unhappy that the book didn't have the impact he thought it would. He said he loved McCone's cover and the female character, that would be Lancer. And then, according to Ange, he picks up the book again, slowly flipping through it, like he's rereading it again. Ange said that at this point, he is totally flummoxed and commented on how much time Claremont was spending with the book. Did this mean a lot to you to write? He asked. And Claremont's reply was that it was just another job, but that he really thought this would stick. I guess the editors thought different. Then he slides the book back to the doctor, who reminds him he hadn't signed it yet, which he did. So thank you, Dr. Ange, first, of course, for sending me this signed book. And of course, thanks for sharing that awesome story about how this hashtag top secret project experience worked out for you. That was a con experience unlike any other. I was working my way through the to-be-read pile recently, mostly to work in all of those Rob Lance books, and noticed that I had a bunch of issues from different runs and eras, publishers even, featuring the same character, one of the 20th century's most popular and prolific creations, as a matter of fact. And I acquired these from a range of sources, including Sir Rob, of course, but also Derek William Crabb, as well as 50-cent boxes at Pulp Reality and a few other places, too, I'm sure. We are talking about Edgar Rice Burroughs' great character, the King of the Apes. And we start with a Marvel adaptation of that character's debut novel, Tarzan of the Apes 1 and 2. This is the format in which I read this 1984 limited series, although it first appeared as a full copy of Marvel Spotlight 29 from the 1970s. And as much as I like the novel, and I do, the comic book form didn't really add much to the story. There's very little dialogue, and the majority of the words are captions, narration boxes. And although the issue was certainly faithful to the Burroughs original and looked like a comic book, for practical purposes, it was an illustrated novel. And the illustrations themselves didn't really add to the story. They just showed a scene of what happened to be happening on that page. Maybe this is my familiarity with the source material that's affecting me, but I just didn't think it was a successful adaptation to a comic book. It was closer to a comic book presentation of the novel material, if that makes sense. It was fine, it was okay, but it lacked some pop. I just don't know how to say it, but it did kind of fall flat. Now, sticking with Marvel, I did read Tarzan Annual No. 1 from 1977. One of the weird things about licensed books is that I've never read this story before, but I've read this story before, which is to say I've read another, a different adaptation of Burroughs, Tarzan's first love, although I can't place where I would have read a comic version of this story. But aspects of the story I knew I'd read before, but not exactly as presented in this issue. So that was a weird experience. Now back from the Gold Key days, I read an issue with the same name, Tarzan of the Apes, 206. The main story here, Tarzan and the Lion Man, was based on an ERB story. And that always helps, although the presence of English-speaking gorillas made me check more than once to see if, just in case, this was actually a DC comic, because they tend to specialize in super smart apes. But no, it was in fact Gold Key. Now, I did read a DC, a Tarzan Family 63 from the mid-70s. The lead story was actually Korak, son of Tarzan, but it also had a John Carter story, which surprised me. But I guess when you license Tarzan, you get the whole Burroughs oeuvre. One cool thing in here was the collection of a story by legendary comic strip creator Hal Foster from the Sunday Tarzan newspaper strips from 1931. Very cool, although it didn't really seem like Tarzan, it seemed more like the type of story he would eventually tell with Prince Valiant. And this issue also had another thing worth mentioning, which is weird, because it wasn't that great an issue, actually, this Tarzan family issue. But it just had things worth talking about, including the Burroughs story, Carson of Venus. Because as I was reading this comic, I was also partway through a big coffee table book called A Pictorial History of Science Fiction by David Kyle. And he told about a feud between Burroughs and writer Otis Klein, who wrote what was basically a John Carter ripoff set on Venus, published in a different magazine. And Burroughs let this be at first, setting a tone of detente, each man writing adventures on their quote-unquote planet. But that lasted only until Klein published a story that took place on Mars. And then as far as ERB was concerned, it was on. And he started cranking out story after story set on Venus, including this one. Now, what was the result of that authorial feud? Well, Edgar Rice Burroughs' properties are still licensed and mined, and you had probably never heard of Otis Klein until about, 45 seconds ago? I also picked up from Pulp Reality, at 50 cents each, the complete miniseries Tarzan, The Savage Heart, 1 through 4, written by Alan Gross, with art by one of my favorites, Mike Grell. I bought this just because I was on a Tarzan kick, and I didn't really notice it was Grell's art until the first big splash of Tarzan, and I looked at it and I thought, what is John Sable doing in my Tarzan comic? Not judging. I'm just saying that Grell's heroes tend to all have a look. The story itself was solid. Tarzan is depressed / angry after the death of Jane. And when a comic company, in this case Dark Horse, gets the Tarzan license, I think they get the entire ERB license. Because in this one, Tarzan ends up in Pellucidar. Which is good because when Tarzan goes up against jungle natives, it can get a little squirrely, if you know what I mean. But in this story, he's going up against another human, and that generally makes a more modern and a more modern day acceptable type of story. And the ending, it just ended with some hope. Let's leave it at that. Again, that story was fine, but as soon as I figured it had Grell art, it flipped to an art first story for me, and it was excellent. Again, that story wasn't too bad either. Now, from there, I decided to stick with ERB and read a chunk of books I'd picked up over the last year or so from dollar and 50 cent boxes featuring the other major creation of his. So from Marvel Comics, I read John Carter, Warlord of Mars 1, 7 through 10, and Annual 2. I've read three of the Carter novels and have enjoyed them, but I haven't read any of the comics. Those first 10 issues tell one long story, Air Pirates of Mars, an original story by Marv Wolfman, but it certainly captured the spirit of the Burroughs stories as far as I could tell. There's a text piece in the first issue by Wolfman talking about being a fan of Burroughs and John Carter as a kid and following the license from company to company for comic books, really wanting to write some John Carter comic book stories. And here at Marvel, he got the chance, and he did a pretty good job with it as well. Annual 2, I enjoyed that a lot as well. It had an original story by Bill Mantlo about head transplanting aliens. And it was terrific. It was action-packed, exciting, had a crazy sci-fi premise, and at its core, it featured the love story between John and Dasia Thoris. And speaking of John Carter's one true love, all of this John Carter reading led me to Warlord of Mars, Dasia Thoris, 1 through 10, from Dynamite from a few years back. Soraya was Joe Crawford, had sent me issue 2 a while back, and I liked that enough to find the rest of these on Hoopla. These issues take place many years before Carter's arrival on Mars, when Dasia was a young princess, albeit just as feisty as when her one true love would later arrive. There was a great storyline in here in which he had to team up with the equally hot and feisty and hot Fondari, a thief and hot corsair from one of Mars's moons, in the story arc, The Hot Pirate Queen of Mars. May have just been called The Pirate Queen of Mars. Anyway, this was definitely a title, Pirate Queen of Mars, reminiscent of Burroughs, that's for sure. And despite being enemies, they of course have to team up to protect an important Martian treasure against the evil Zen Brega, who wants the treasure for himself. Fun, adventurous, and I quite enjoyed it. And from World's Greatest Comics, when for the sale a year or so ago, the quarter books were 6 for a dollar, I read Gammarauders 2 through 6. I've read a few of these DC TSR books over the last few months, last year, and they varied in quality, but it's possible that these were the ones I enjoyed the least. The vaguely manga-style art wasn't to my taste, and Peter Begillis's writing style was his normal weirdness. And I admit that I struggled with the bad guys being called slugnoids. So I'm guessing that there probably is something in here in these books, but I just couldn't get into the series. And between Cheap Bins and the DC app, I read a handful of books from the DC 1 Million event. Aquaman, Catwoman, Chase, and Resurrection Man. It started with Chase, which I saw had a 1 million issue on the DC app after I'd read through the rest of her regular title, and that led me to read these other ones. I know that this was a connected event, but I hoped that reading the random standalones wouldn't be too much of a burden, and generally it wasn't. The Catwoman story did follow on from the Batman title, but I was able to keep up with it. And Aquaman and Resurrection Man in particular told entertaining stories within that premise of having heroes from the 20th century meeting and changing places with their counterparts from the 853rd century. And of course, that's a crazy premise, but most of these issues handled that nuttiness pretty well. Now, last time I talked about Derek William Crabb's care package. Derek is, of course, from the Fan Holes podcast. And I read a trade he sent of Rick Veitch's Abraxas and the Earthman. These originally appeared as short chapters in 8 or 10 issues of Epic Illustrated from the early 1980s. The story is basically a space retelling of Moby Dick with a literal peg-leg space captain chasing a literal space whale. But it's Rick Veitch, so it's weird, like beyond Peter Begillis weird. The space whales were our space ancestors, having colonized the galaxy millennia ago. And the space pirates do very strange and creepy things to those that they press into service, including an Earthman, our lead character Isaac. As a result of these medical actions, Isaac becomes empathically linked to the space whales. And that medical process is really weird and ugly. This was an independent book from the 80s, so what can we say? Interesting story, and it actually had a decent resolution, which the nuttier and crazier stories don't always pull off very well. As we say around here, endings are hard. So, but I give Rick Veitch a lot of credit for this. The trade also includes a 4 or 5 page text piece by Veitch from 2006, looking back on this early story in his career, at that point, 25 years before. Now, I'm not a fan of weird for weird's sake, and sometimes I think Veitch does that. But more often he does weird for some other narrative sake. And when he does that, like he does here with Abraxas and the Earthman, it ends up being a pretty good and interesting story. I also picked up a trade of a comic series I've been working my way through, and now that it's done, I was able to finish it up. So I read The Walking Dead 181 to 193. Rick ends up getting to know the ways of the Commonwealth and their governor, whose title still kind of freaks him out. And as always happens, when Rick runs into a group that does things just a little bit differently from how his group does things, and there are definitely troubling things in the Commonwealth, that's true. But Rick just can't let anyone be. If they organize themselves differently from he does, with different priorities or practices or even different goals, this cannot stand. Even if Michonne has bought in completely to be with her daughter. And then we get to the last trade and the last issue as well. And I have to say that I'm not a big fan of the actual ending of the series, the way 193 wrapped things up. I thought all along that the lesson was that whatever Rick Grimes does, he makes things worse and more people die. I interpreted The Walking Dead as a cautionary tale against his bullheaded style of leadership. I don't think he was actually a role model, which seems to have been the case all along, I suppose. Again, based on the way this ended. Despite that having gone completely past me all these years. I've heard writers say that when they write a character for a long time, they grow fond of them and start, you know, taking their sides on things. And I suppose that's what happened here, as Rick has become the legend, the leader, the bringer of peace to this dead world, our role model. And that makes no sense to me. I also think I missed a little bit along the way, maybe in prior issues, that zombieism is now only spread via bites. Someone who's been reading all along is caught up. Please let me know about this. They mention numerous times that many people have not seen the dead walk in many years. So nobody has died since then? No accidents, no heart attacks, nothing like that? Clearly I'm missing something. And like I said, I'd like to know what it is I've missed. Now from Hoopla, I read some from a current title that I've been working on. Always a trade or two behind, but that's all right by me. So I read Batman 55 through 60, and also the Batman Secret Files, number 1, and Batman Annual 3. Batman is still pretty mad about the whole not getting married thing, and in these ones, Bane really has him chasing his tail. Is Bane running Arkham and putting hits out on Wayne and Alfred? Or is he a gibbering pile of crazy, locked in his cell 24/7? Because there is strong evidence for both of those being the case. And we'll just have to see how it all shakes out. In the two special issues, Secret Files and the Annual, we get some different takes. The Secret Files issues was 5 stories in 52 pages, and my favorite was called The World's Greatest Detective and Batman, because it featured one of my favorite characters, Bobo, aka Detective Chimp. I wasn't even sure I was reading a DC comic until the Talking Monkey showed up. And the Annual, terrific story written by Tom Taylor about Alfred. Really well done, and a nice, poignant ending. I also read the next trade of a series I've been working my way through recently from Zenoscope, Grimm Fairy Tales 43-50, which really does wrap up the original storyline from this title. And what I've liked about this is that for a title that trades so much, at least on the covers, on its pin-up cheesecake style of art, this has actually built up a story from the beginning, in terms of an ongoing plot, a big battle between good and evil, and it finally comes to a conclusion in this trade. And the last few issues leading up to 50, they made sure that the reader was reminded of this fact, with a quantity of editor's footnotes that made me think I was reading a book from 1974. But lots of drama, lots of fairy tale and mythological beings, demons and bad guys, and because it's Zenoscope, lots of bad girls. And like I said, a solid ending to a surprisingly more intricate title than I expected. I will eventually continue on with this title, I think, but I might poke around some other Zenoscope books first. I hope that I can find another one as well plotted as this one, but I imagine the cheesecake factor might be pumped up a bit in those other series, although that's just a stereotype that I'm bringing with me to Zenoscope. Like I've said before, there was a time 4 or 5 trades back when this title, Grimm Fairy Tales, had just about jumped the shark for me, when the interior art had become as ridiculous as the covers. But they dialed that back just enough for me to keep reading and enjoying. But other Zenoscope titles, maybe we'll see. I also picked up a Spider-Gwen trade on Hoopla containing Edge of Spider-Verse number 2 and Spider-Gwen 1-5. This is from an alternate world, another world in the Spider-Verse, in which Gwen Stacy is in the rock band The Mary Janes and is also the costumed vigilante Spider-Gwen. Her father is a cop, but also Frank Castle is. And there are some other odd changes in this world. As a fan of alternative worlds and what-ifs, I found this a pretty fun read. And I admit that I went into these issues with a bit of a chip on my shoulder, because I'm a fan of the character Silk, and I think, personally, that the popularity of Silk floundered when Spider-Gwen came along. But I think I was fair, all in all, and I thought this was a pretty solidly entertaining read. And another Archie read from Hoopla, Pep Digital 73, Gridiron Glory, which I finished up on the first week of professional football season, the second week of college football season, which around here in the Columbus, Ohio area is pretty close to being professional. Good stories, good variety of lead characters, actually. We get stories starring Coach Cleats and one with Mr. Weatherby, and even one involving Mr. Svensson, the school janitor, and his heroic efforts to save a victory for the football team. Fun read, and of course, next month, it'll be time for some Halloween Archie Digital goodness. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, I enjoyed the Deja Thoris series and the John Carter Annual number 2. Batman Annual 1 also was good. Indiana Jones issue 1 was good. Partridge Family was, okay, just kidding, that was terrible. But in terms of what I thought was best, it's Doom. Just Doom. Specifically, Heroes Reborn, Doomsday, Hail Doom. Now, next month, I'm going to knock out the rest of that Deja Thoris omnibus, read the start, at least, of the latest Lady Mechanica storyline, and I'm going to jump into some horror and monster books for Halloween times, but I'm not sure where else the reading muse will take me. But whatever I do end up reading, I will be here to talk about those books I read in October, and that episode ought to be out sometime in early November. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com. Or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode, the blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And, of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.